and welcome to the Endocrine Outlook. I'm Patrick Campbell, Senior Editor of the Endocrinology Network, and in this episode, you'll hear my interview with Dr. Jamie Hartman-Boyce, Senior Research Fellow and Departmental Lecturer at the Nuffield Department of Primary Care Health Sciences at the University of Oxford. Dr. Hartman-Boyce is the lead investigator of a recent article published in Diabetes Care, providing an overview of potential associations between COVID-19 and diabetes. Published in June, the article proved to be a valuable resource for clinicians during the ongoing pandemic. We reached out to Dr. Hartman-Boyce to learn more about the role of medical research during the COVID-19 era, and that interview is the subject of the recent segment. Dr. Hartman-Boyce, if you wouldn't mind giving our guests a little bit of introduction on who you are, then we can dive into our discussion.
So hi everyone, my name is Jamie Hartman-Boyce and I'm a senior research fellow and departmental lecturer in the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine, and that's based at the Nuffield Department of Primary Care Health Sciences at the University of Oxford in the UK. I also happen to have type 1 diabetes myself, and that's where my interest in this particular research came from.
All right, thank you for that. And now for those of you who don't know, Dr. Hartman-Boyce was one of the lead authors on a recent paper published in Diabetes Care, sort of giving everybody an overview of diabetes and COVID-19. Now, we've had a lot of information come out related to diabetes and COVID-19, even more since your paper was published about a month ago now. What would you like the main takeaways from your paper to be from people that read it?
I suppose at the time I wrote it, there was quite limited evidence available. We are getting more evidence, but we still need more. So I think one of the key messages to researchers in this field is that we need better studies, better reported studies, more thoughtful analysis of the data. And then I think the other message is really, I suppose there are three. One is about, in the absence of good evidence, where we can turn for learning and to help us make decisions. And I think we have a couple options here. One is to learn from experiences of other countries, because different countries are at different stages in terms of their experience with this pandemic. And that's why we brought together experts from countries who had experienced high levels of COVID-19 at the time of writing to talk a little bit about what was going on in their countries and their healthcare systems. The other place we can learn information from is really from previous events that have disrupted diabetes care. And obviously those won't be quite the same as COVID-19. We can look to other pandemics, but there isn't very much on recent pandemics that have had quite as much of an impact. But what we also did in an article was we looked at evidence from natural disasters and other events like that, which caused kind of widespread population level disruptions, either to medical care, to transport, to diet, to activity, or most likely a combination of those. And we can learn from those and the strategies that were employed then, and also who was most impacted by those disasters, around what interventions we might want to roll out to support people with diabetes at the moment. I think the other two things we found when reviewing the literature, which to me were very striking absences, one was everything I found essentially focused on the medical management of diabetes and during this pandemic, and not so much on the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on the mental well-being of people with diabetes. COVID-19 is affecting everyone's mental well-being to some extent, but with people with diabetes, it might be the first time in their lives they've been labeled as vulnerable, which we've had some feedback from patients has been, for some people, quite an interesting and hard experience. And also COVID-19 for many of us, myself included, represented big disruptions to my diet and physical activity, which of course are mainstays of all diabetes management. So all of a sudden when kind of the pandemic hit here, we'd been regular online grocery shoppers, we couldn't get our regular online groceries. So we were eating different food. A lot of my physical activity prior to the pandemic had been active commuting. So like walking places to bring my kids to work, et cetera. None of which I thought of as major things, but I realized when I stopped having my walks to work, that had a really profound impact on my morning blood sugars. So things like that, and the way in which lifestyles have been disrupted, there didn't seem to be very much focus on. And the other thing that there seemed nothing on when we looked at the literature, and I think this has started to change a little bit, are inequalities. We know that COVID-19 is not an equal opportunities disease. It doesn't affect everyone in the same way. It affects some groups more than others. And those groups tend to be the groups that are also bearing more of a burden of diabetes to start with. So really thinking about the potential of this pandemic to exacerbate those existing health disparities, particularly for people with diabetes, and ways in which we might try to mitigate its impact.
All right, thank you. Now, my next question was going to be related to what would you like, or what do you think has changed since this was published? But I wanted to touch on your first point a little bit there. How valuable has it been from a research standpoint? It almost sounds bad to call it valuable, but to see this pandemic take hold in different countries at different points and to see how their reactions to it have really determined their success or failure in managing the disease. How valuable has that been for you as a researcher?
I think it's of enormous value, really. I would still rather it wasn't happening, of course, but it is happening. And I think when we think about especially making policies or writing guidelines, we're used to being able to do that with a lot of time, right? And a lot of evidence. And we can go out and we can review everything that's been done in an area and make really informed decisions. And at the moment, guideline developers, policymakers are facing a really tricky situation. And I think we should be very open to learning from other countries and other experiences to try and make sense of what we should do in our individual countries and when coming up with clinical guidelines. I think a really key component of that, of course, is that the most important thing, I suppose, is that other countries share their data in a way that's reliable and transparent, and also that if they are rolling out interventions to support people with diabetes, that these are evaluated. So often in times like these, in crisis situations, a lot of interventions might be rolled out, and no one's actually thinking about how do I tell if this intervention worked, if it was effective, if it's worth doing. And as the situation progresses, if we start getting data from other countries that say, we did this, we use this system to support people with diabetes, and this is what happened, that really allows policymakers and guideline developers throughout the world to make more informed choices about what they're going to do at this present moment.
All right, thank you for that. And now just sort of going through different portions of your paper, COVID-19 and contracting the infection or contracting the disease, especially we're seeing now even some data suggesting that HbA1c level, regardless of a type 2 diabetes or type 1 diabetes diagnosis, was linked to increased risk and of contracting the disease and increased severity. Is there any other important things or important research that has come out that you think people should know about if they come across your study in regards to this subject?
Specifically in regards to contracting the disease, is that where we are?
Or we could discuss severity of the disease as well.
Yeah, so I think I would definitely separate those two things. As far as I know, the information we have on contracting the disease is just still so limited as to almost not be very useful. And that's because until we're doing kind of widespread community testing, including of asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic individuals, the cases that we're seeing and that are getting picked up by testing are very much the tip of an iceberg. Here in the UK now, anyone with kind of core symptoms can get tested, but certainly back in March and April, which is what most of our data is still coming from, that wasn't the case. And it was really only if you were very unwell that you would then be tested and you would be counted as having COVID-19. So I think in that sense, from what I've seen, it's just impossible to say based on the data, people with diabetes are at an increased risk of contracting COVID. Now, of course, it's quite clear at this point from the data that people with diabetes are at an increased risk of severe COVID, which would also mean they'd be overrepresented in most of our testing data because they'd be more likely to show up in healthcare settings or hospitals where they would get tested. And there does absolutely seem to be a link there with HbA1c. And that, for me and for many, I don't think that's necessarily a surprise. You know, we absolutely know that people with diabetes are more prone to more severe infections and that the severity of that often is associated with blood glucose control over time. It was quite good to start seeing studies which were looking at HbA1c, because at the beginning of this, and one of the cautions about the data that I think we put in the paper, was we were having some studies which were saying, oh, there's a very clear association because we have people with high blood sugar readings having more severe infection And you thought, well, if those are the blood sugar readings that they're taking in hospital, then also more severe infection is going to make your blood glucose control harder. So it's good to see studies that are taking that longer term view and using HbA1c or other data, for example, on diabetes complications, to make sense of some of the important risk factors when it comes to COVID-19 in people with diabetes.
All right, and now backtracking to the sort of indirect risk, you guys addressed it here and you addressed it in your first response, the indirect risk to people with diabetes posed by this pandemic. What kind of impact could this have on sort of the long-term health of many diabetics? People, as you stated, aren't able to get out more. And there's also this sort of, it's been termed COVID phobia, where people are avoiding going to seeking medical attention for things they need or even just regular visits. What type of long-term implications could this pandemic have on diabetes populations?
Yeah, so I worry if not handled well, and perhaps even if handled very well, we will most likely be in a situation where we see an increase in diabetes-related complications. So kind of at a starting level, probably what we'll see are higher HbA1c levels. And we suspect that that will probably lead to more complications, and data from other events that were disruptive have shown increased complications in terms of amputations, certainly in terms of cardiovascular issues, and also in some cases, exacerbations of hypertension and other contributory factors. So I think I worry that that is what we are looking at. So one thing we didn't write about in our paper, but I think recently came out, I want to say from a study in Germany, but somewhere in Western Europe that I saw the other day, was around newly diagnosed people with type 1 diabetes, much higher rates of diabetic ketoacidosis and very serious diabetic ketoacidosis in people when presenting at time of diagnosis. And that might very well be linked to that COVID phobia as you were referring to. So not seeking help earlier, or also healthcare systems being overburdened. So I think when we think about the multitude of ways in which this pandemic has affected people with diabetes and healthcare systems more broadly, it seems almost inevitable that we are going to be facing a period of greater healthcare need in people with diabetes. But I think that will also depend very much on the healthcare systems in place. So in places with universal health coverage, at least we will hopefully have a situation where even if mass unemployment does come, people won't be losing their health insurance coverage. That will be different in different countries, and I really worry about that. So I think not all countries will be affected the same, just as not all countries have been affected the same in terms of the immediate impact of COVID. I also think in terms of the longer term impact of COVID on people with diabetes, that will in many ways be a reflection of the healthcare systems that we have in place and what's being done to support people.
Okay, I'm glad you touched on that, because that fits nicely into a question I had. How, obviously you guys looked at a whole sort of gamut of different countries and their approaches and how they've fared throughout this pandemic, and things have evolved a little bit since then, even though it's been a little less than a month. How has the different healthcare systems in place really sort of dictated the success or failure of these countries in addressing the pandemic?
Difficult for me to say that with any certainty, partly because I think, you know, we know number of infections, kind of, we know number of deaths, kind of, but our data is still actually not very clear on impact. But I agree with you, it is becoming more clear. I suppose in the absence of good evidence, all I can do is speak from personal experience. And John Buse, one of the contributors to our article in Diabetes Care, shared some information in the article about, for example, people finding it difficult to get virtual consultations, so either by phone or video, because of healthcare reimbursement structures. Now, I grew up in the States. Most of my life as a diabetic was in the States. And still, that hadn't even struck me as a possible problem, right? Like, that hadn't occurred to me. Here, I have had some contact with my healthcare providers. It's been over the phone. That's been completely fine. I at no point worried about reimbursement, nor did they in that regard. And so I think when you think of these multitude of barriers, they're going to start cropping up in terms of access to healthcare, access to healthcare professionals, and also access to prescriptions. There's going to be a real difference between countries. But all I can do is speak from personal experience there without having seen kind of more data on that. And I think that'll that'll probably take months to emerge in a way that we can really start looking for patterns and maybe drawing conclusions from it.
Thank you for that. Yeah, it's definitely a difficult thing to speak on so early on. So I thank you for attempting an answer for me. How has, you touched on it there as well, telehealth has played a big role in this pandemic, especially for diabetics. How has telehealth really aided countries in addressing the needs of their diabetic patients during this pandemic?
Yeah, so there's, I think different countries have rolled out different responses. So as we cover in the diabetes care article, at the time of writing, some countries had really rolled out quite large campaigns using text message, mobile apps, websites. Other countries, not so much. And I think we need to see evaluations of those, really, and I think some of them are underway. We know from other evidence and remote consultations that it can be really useful, but that evidence tends to be from very different contexts where people might have also been receiving face-to-face support and then this on top. And I think one of my concerns, which I hope proves unfounded, but I'm not sure it will, is that telehealth will help some people way more than it helps others. So we can't assume that everyone has access to high-speed internet or that everyone necessarily knows how to use their mobile phones effectively. And also, I think there's an expectation, at least in some of these systems, on the patient to be proactive. So the patient kind of has to make the first step, seek that information, register for the website, whatever it might be. And so I worry that actually the people in the most need of support still will not be being reached by telehealth. And we might be looking at a situation where we're exacerbating disparities in health even more. But again, I think it's too early to say for sure on that.
Well, I think it's definitely a real concern, especially given we've seen data showing how much just trust in the sort of healthcare system will impact how people reach out for healthcare, especially in times of need.
Absolutely.
Now, just going forward for you, is there any particular areas that you're going to keep a focus on as a researcher that you think could really prove valuable to clinicians practicing?
Yeah, so what I really hope to continue to focus on, but it's somewhat funding dependent, so I'm in the process of trying to seek funding to support some of this work, is to keep on evaluating what countries are doing to support people with diabetes during this pandemic, and also the effects on people with diabetes, with a real focus on the indirect effects. So not so much looking at, okay, how many people with diabetes have contracted COVID, how many of them have ended up having severe infection, but instead saying, okay, if we actually put aside that infection data in our non-infected cohort, what's happening with them? And I think as we get that data, which is starting to emerge, it will help us be able to shape our policies and our guidelines moving forward in two ways. One is, of course, if we see effective interventions that have been rolled out by another country, we can try and learn from those. But I also think it's really important that we start identifying in a resource-constrained setting who needs the most support and how to contact them. So information from previous natural disasters seems to suggest that the toll can be particularly pronounced in people of lower socioeconomic status and people who rely on insulin. So for example, if we start seeing that coming out with COVID as well, and we see that consistently across the data from other similar disruptions, then that might be a place where a clinician or a practice nurse might say, okay, we only have so much scope to proactively contact all of our patients with diabetes. Let's try and focus on those with an HbA1c above a certain level who maybe live in a more deprived community and who are dependent on insulin, so that within a resource-constrained setting, we are actually targeting our support people who need it most. So that's what I hope to be able to keep looking at over time.
All right, well, I'll make sure I check back in a couple months to see. Now, just lastly, from a personal perspective, it's been really sort of incredible to see the rate of information that's come out about this virus in such a short period of time, in a time where a lot of healthcare facilities are sort of furloughing people or operating at minimal staff. What's it been like for you as a researcher? I'm sure you've been busier than ever. What's it been like from your perspective? compared to how it's been throughout the rest of your career?
Yeah, so it's been an extremely busy time, as you might imagine. And my job generally is to kind of assimilate information. So the main thing I do is evidence synthesis, which means bringing together data from lots of different studies to come up with kind of a best approximate reflection of the state of evidence to help inform policymakers and guideline developers. And so the absolute sheer pace and volume of data coming out during this has been hard to stay on top of. And some of the evidence has also been very, very poor. But it can be difficult, especially when you're looking at articles that are preprint only, so haven't been peer reviewed yet, to understand what some of the weaknesses are in those studies without reading them fully. So I find myself having to read a lot of papers, and then some of them by the end saying, actually, I just discount this entirely, but I can't really figure that out until I've read it. So I've been quite busy in that way. I think for me on a personal level, it's been a very busy time, but I can't imagine anything I'd rather be doing. I feel extremely privileged to be in a position where I can do research in this area and hopefully help contribute to knowledge and to the care of people with diabetes and people like me. And I think science, when it's at its absolute best, is a collaborative effort. And we are seeing, in many cases, some really strong collaborations, both internationally and within countries, to try and get the data out there. And so it's, you know, I feel just very, very grateful that this is my job at a time like this. I'd rather a time like this had never come around, but if it was going to, I'm glad that I'm in the role I'm in.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And thank you for all your contributions you've made as a researcher. That's about it. All my questions. Thank you again for taking the time to speak with me today. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
That's it for this episode of the Endocrine Outlook. I'm Patrick Campbell, senior editor of the Endocrinology Network. Thank you for listening.